Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Thank you all for coming. Let's start with the serenity prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can. And no wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. Actually, this is the sort of occasion where I need more of the third step prayer of God. I offer myself and this situation to you to do with as you wish. And if you want to have me make an ass of myself, this is your opportunity. The topic for this workshop is you can't make me angry. But the rest of the title, you can't make me angry without my consent. And it's a takeoff from Eleanor Roosevelt having said, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. That nobody has control over your emotions unless you give it to them. And I didn't come to AA because I was an alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic. I only came to AA because getting a pass to come to AA meetings was the only way I could get a pass to get off the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. It really wasn't all that funny. I was there by mistake. Anyway, I ended up in AA, and I found out that that really made the psychiatrist happy that I was going to AA meetings. So to make him even happier, I went it every day so I could get the man to take me and to get enough brownie points to get discharged from the hospital, which eventually happened. And I had no intentions of going back because I wasn't an alcoholic. I did plan on lying to the psychiatrist and telling him how many meetings I was going to, and I told Max that to confirm what I said, whatever I said to the psychiatrist. And but the problem, as I think I said before, was that Max liked the AA meetings. She would rather go to the meetings than to sit at home and watch me drink. And she even liked that better than going to a movie with me. And when I found out she liked that, I used that as a threat to not go to AA anymore unless she behaved. And that didn't make it better, it made it worse because she went off to meetings by herself. And so I had to go to meetings to find out what she was going to meetings for and why people were, why she enjoyed them so much and what they were laughing about. And I sat in AA meetings and I talked to the men at the men's stag meeting and explained to them why I drank. That if they had my problems, if they had my patients, if they had my wife, they would drink too. And I spent 7 months trying to convince them that I didn't drink because I was an alcoholic. I drank because of my problems. People and situations drove me to drink. And after 7 months, I came to the realization that there was absolutely nothing that I could go and tell the people in AA why I drank, and they would say to me, "You're right. You have a right. That's bad enough. You have a right to drink." And they would pass the word around that he's really not an alcoholic. He drinks because he has a real good reason. And in other words, they did not buy the fact that anybody drove me to drink or any situation drove me to drink. Well, now I've been sober a while. I haven't had a drink since July 31st, 1967. But I find that people in particular really drive me nuts. People give me more trouble than anybody. And Max has shaped up a lot. But you know, people who are married and divorced and married and divorced and married and divorced, and that's rough. That's painful. But you know, staying steadily married to the same person for 58 years, that's no bed of roses either. I mean, I came in with the idea that people could control my emotions to the point where they could make me drink. And I realized that the same thing is true today, that if I don't take care of my own emotional sobriety, there's always a risk that I will say, what's the use in taking a drink? And I can't afford to let anybody control my physical sobriety. And if I don't want my physical sobriety to be at risk, then I can't afford to let people control my emotional sobriety. And besides, it feels good to feel good. And I'm willing to go to any length at all. I can't conceive of any length to which I am not willing to go to maintain my physical sobriety. And I am getting to a point where I'm willing to go to practically the same lengths in order to maintain my emotional sobriety. So my emotional sobriety has become increasingly important to me for practical purposes, for practical reasons. I read the other day, it was in Language of the Heart, the book of things that B.O.W. has written in the Grapevine. Bill said that he had observed that a lot of the oldsters, was the word he used, but we refer to them as old timers, didn't have emotional sobriety all the time. And that he thought that perhaps they would become the spearhead for the new frontier in AA of emotional sobriety. We kid and laugh a lot about our emotions, and I always say I'm a sensitive alcoholic, and we talk about how sensitive we are and how emotional we are. But I think that my point in this is I want to take a few minutes to be serious about our emotional sobriety, because I think it's so important. And I think that I need to focus on that. As a matter of fact, it's not quite relevant, but I was surprised in medical school when they said, in teaching about psychoses, they said that mentally ill people do not think, or not, their emotions are no different than ours, except to a matter of degree. They're qualitatively the same, and only quantitatively different. And yet we allow people to control our emotions and thereby our thinking, and how risky that can be. Anyhow, one of the things along this line that has helped me a great deal was Father Barney used to come down from Seattle to our area and put on retreats for Alcoholics Anonymous until he died. I don't know what he's been doing since, but he liked to break sobriety down like a baseball diamond. And he said that first base was physical sobriety, second base was mental sobriety, third base was emotional sobriety, and home plate was spiritual sobriety. And I like that. I like breaking things down, just like I like breaking sobriety down into a day at a time. In fact, along that, I can visualize that diamond, that the first step, the admitting the powers of alcohol, comes right after physical sobriety. And the second step, came to believe that power greater self could restore us to sanity, is right at second base, mental sobriety. And I visualize the rest of the steps on the rest of that diamond. And we all are, and I visualize all of us, in fact, I visualize Al-Anon as being right beyond first base. once you get to first base and move beyond that, you can't really, in a sense, distinguish between Al-Anons and alcoholics, because we're all striving for the same thing from there on. But anyhow, I see all of us on that diamond and always in motion. We're either moving further into spiritual sobriety or we're drifting back to where we came from. We can't stand still. We're getting more spiritually sober or drifting back to where we came from. I like that concept. I like that. Because I was told very early in sobriety, that I had a disease that was following me and would always be there. And there's no way for me to tell how far back it is other than to stand still and wait for it to catch me. And I don't want that to happen. So I keep moving. And I like that concept. It keeps me moving. And so that's where that's the sense in which I try to work on my spiritual sobriety, getting things moving forward in that. One of the most difficult things about my staying sober is I drift so easily into the victim role. I see the victim role so much in my life. What people are doing to me, what situations are doing to me, and And in working with people, I find that there's nothing that I can think of as a more useless role to be in than the victim role, where you're blaming other people. When a person's wallowing in self-pity, there's really nothing, you can't help them. I know a situation where I did help. I had two guys. They were both in the victim role. They were both whining all the time, constantly talking about their problems. You couldn't get them out of that situation. All they wanted to talk about was how bad it was and how bad their lives were. And they were just a real bore to listen to. You know what I did? I gave them each the other guy's phone number. And you know, strangely enough, they both immediately recognize the other guy's problem. You know. I've never heard from him again since, and that's fine. The business of assigning blame is so much a part of my life that, and yet I find that assigning blame is a completely useless situation. I mean, if you're in a relationship and you're trying to figure out which one of you is to blame, once you figure that out, you've got nothing. I find it much more practical to figure out who's going to be the first to stop this. Who's going to be the first to say, let's call a halt to this and start over. Let's call a truce, or whatever it is. In fact, I had a case of that where I was secretary of my home group, which was fine. It would have been fine. Except some other guy had been secretary before I was, and he had done a much better job than I was doing, which is would have been okay, except he would deliberately come in and do things that I hadn't quite done to show me and show the whole world what a jerky secretary I was. He was doing it deliberately to upset me. We couldn't stand each other. For obvious reason, because of what he was doing, it was his fault. And we ended up at a couple's retreat. And on Friday, late afternoon, the people were all coming in, he and his spouse came in, and I thought, oh, he's here. I thought, I'm not going to spend the whole weekend with this guy and feel bad about it. So I said to him, I said, you know, you and I don't hit it off. Could we sit down and have a cup of coffee and talk? And we did, and we talked, and we got things straightened out. You know, I find the best thing I can do with the resentment is to talk to the person that I resent. And he did the same thing, and we got it all ironed out. Had a pleasant weekend. Sunday noon, it's time to break up and go home, and we're all saying goodbye to everybody. He comes by and I said goodbye to him. I said, I'm really glad we sat and had our talk and got these things straightened out. He said, yeah, so am I. And he says, damn it, you were the one that initiated it. boy, did I feel good. You know, I finally, I got the guy, you know. I was the one that initiated you to talk. And I passed that on. If you're having problems with somebody, be the one that can take the credit for getting the thing straightened out. It's that one last chance you have to really get them. And, I'll never forget that one. I've written down a few things that I have chosen to believe. And one of them is that I choose to believe that life is basically one long, long series of communication problems. In other words, I have relationships with people, places, things, items, situations, and my communications to, among, and about those relationships. So it's all just a communication problem. And which, by thinking that way, I have developed an interest in learning to communicate effectively and efficiently, more so than before. And I'm not good at it, but I'm sure a lot better than I used to be, because I used to keep it all in my head, and now I've been practicing it. And we were talking about that just a little while ago, how to communicate effectively, assertively, not passively, not aggressively, but assertively. And that's been an interesting hobby of mine. Secondly, a measure of communication is the result it produces. I read that someplace. Didn't mean much to me till one day I went to a Saturday morning afternoon seminar by Sister B, a wonderful gal. It was on communication. That's why I went, and besides because of Sister B. During the question and answer period, somebody asked the question, "What is communication?" And I thought, well, that's about the dumbest question I ever heard. But then I was surprised when Sister B couldn't really communicate, or couldn't define communication. And I was even more upset when she turned to me and said, "Paul, how would you define that?" I couldn't figure out how to define it, but I remembered the statement that a measure of communication is the result it produces. Now, I've taken that as a challenge. If I'm not getting along with a person in whatever situation, rather than blaming that person or trying to find out the cause of all this, I'm best off if I think I'm not communicating effectively. I accept the challenge of improving that situation by improving my communications with the person. And that's that has helped me a great deal. A measure of communication is the result it produces. And if I don't like the result I'm getting, I'm not doing it well. I'm not communicating well. Oh, here's one you may not like. It may not even be true, but I choose to believe it. And I choose to believe that people treat me the way I've taught them to treat me. If I don't like the way somebody's treating me, there's something I can do about it. There's something I should do about it, other than bitch about it. I need to change what I'm doing. If I want somebody else to change, I've got to change first. People treat me the way I've taught them to treat me. And if I don't like the way I'm being treated, it's because I am not acting the way I should be acting. And to me, it's a real challenge, but I like that. And that's where I get this fact of that you can't make me angry without my consent, because I am responsible for my emotional state. In fact, I even wrote this out to Max. I wrote out a declaration of emotional independence and gave it to her. And what I said was that as of that date, she would no longer be the cause of my emotional state. From that day on, I could no longer say to her, "You made me angry." I could say, what you did, I didn't like, and I chose to get angry about it. But my anger was my choice. She can't make me angry. Nobody can make me angry. People can do things, and I can choose to be angry, but they can't make me angry, burn me any more than they can make me happy, or make me anything else. It's my choice. The nice part about that, though, is that it works the other way. I don't make anybody else angry. I don't upset anybody else. If they get upset at what I do, that's their choice. Unless I deliberately try to upset somebody, but then that's something that only I can decide that. And then I have to go back and make amends for that, and I don't like to make amends. They're not my favorite thing to do. So I have my independence, and Max has hers, and it has worked out that way a great deal. And of course, emotional independence is the key to emotional sobriety. I know a couple that I work with that this fella was raised by his mother more than by both parents. I don't mean where the father was, but he grew up, he trained his mother so that when she didn't act the way he wanted her to, he would pout to punish her for what she had done. And if she didn't notice that he was pouting, he'd have to pout louder. And he would make her feel miserable bad enough, long enough, that she would change her behavior so he would change his behavior. And he trained her so well that he became very proficient at that. Now he's in a relationship with a woman, not his mother, who is a recovering alcoholic who doesn't take crap from anybody. He will do this stuff to pout and nag at her to where she gets upset and responds. And he, when she responds vigorously, he's even more free to get his passive aggressive stuff going, and he really needles her more until she does something really outlandish, gets physical, and so on. And then he says, "Did you see what she just did? Can you believe that anybody would act like that? Can you just look at this crazy one?" Yeah, and then he's won. He's won. Trouble is, by winning, everybody loses on that. But the point is that he manipulates people by making them feel responsible for how he feels, and she is manipulated, and she accepts that responsibility and tries to fight back from it. They both allow the other one to control their emotions. The very thing I was trying to talk about, avoiding, but it has to be avoided. I mean, you just can't live that way. I was trying to think of things that I had done to try to improve this. And as a hobby, the things I read, are you familiar with Harville Hendrix and his book? What does he write? Keeping the love you get and getting all the love you want, or something like that. As I recall, Harvard Hendrix, the main thing he does, he says that a couple have chosen each other for whatever reason they think they've chosen each other. They've chosen each other because of their inner defects. That a person picks a partner to work out the problems left over from their childhood, things having to do with the parents. And what he teaches is that, this is a real tricky thing, for the two people in the relationship to help each other to work out their individual problems without becoming part of the problem, so that they stay distant from it, and that each one helps the other one to grow emotionally without becoming defensive and without becoming a part of the problem. And they have this long series of things you do to work through the whole book, the workbook in that. Gary Spence, the attorney, You've all heard of him, seen him on TV. He, as I understand it, he's never lost a case. He's a tremendous defense attorney. He's written a book called How to Argue and Win Every Time. What I got out of that book was one really basic element, and that was that you should never fear your opponent, because your opponent only has as much power as you give them. If you're afraid of your opponent, you give them a lot of power, they're going to win, but it's up to you. They only have as much power over you as you give them. And I find that a very important concept, that they you have control over that. Another book was George Thompson. He wrote Verbal Judo. I don't like the word judo because it sounds like martial arts and warring, but I know judo is based on the idea of not resisting the other person, using their energy to defeat them and that. But the point is that Thompson was a policeman and then a prison guard, and then studied literature and wrote this book. And his whole thing is he enjoys teaching people how to go into a difficult situation, as policemen often do, and be a calming influence, and not allowing other people to control you, where you control the situation, often with humor and with handling it in appropriate ways. It's a way of taking the sting out of difficult situations and calming them. And I found that very helpful. But one I really liked was John Gottman. John Gottman wrote Why Marriages Succeed and Fail and How You Can Make Yours Last. And he has a lot of good stuff in there. But one of the things I really like was he just distinguishes between a criticism and a complaint. Now he says that to complain to your partner about something you don't like is sensible and logical, because if you don't complain, you keep storing the things up and then you dump them all on in anger. And it's better to mention your complaint and get it out of the way. The critical point, though, is to not criticize. The criticism is a character assassination. An example might be, I don't like that dress. That's a complaint. I complain about the dress. A criticism would be, you look fat. You really have offended the other person. And that sets up the thing. I see many relationships that have difficult because of that, because the person actually goes too far and gets into the other person's character, and they become very defensive and ready to fight naturally, rather than just it being a complaint.